I'm trying to get the attention of an intelligent world to a neglected subject. The Way of the Shaman. Michael Horner. Michael Horner teaches anthropology in the graduate faculty of the New York School, or the New School for Social Research in New York. He's currently co-chairman of the anthropology section of the New York Academy of Sciences. He's been visiting professor at Columbia, Yale, and the University of California, Berkeley, where he received his Ph.D. Served as assistant director of the Lowy Museum of Anthropology. His research has taken him repeatedly to the upper Amazon forests of South America, as well as to the western North America and Mexico. His books include The Jivaro, Shamanism, and a recent novel, Cannibal, which he co-authored. He has attained in shamanism the title White Shaman. He teaches shamanism as a healing art. Now, shamanism is as old as the records we can find about man in anthropology and archaeology. Shamanism is another thing mocked by ivory-towered professors who've never encountered the reality of, quote, witch doctors and voodoo in ancient culture. I told you a few weeks ago that I witnessed, and I usually have someone who can find these things for me. There's bound to be someone in the entertainment, film, or scientific community that can help me locate the source of a film that was shown on television a couple of years ago. It was a film of the work of a shaman in Southeast Asia, in the peninsula of Malaysia, Borneo, I believe, but I'm not sure. Somewhere in either the East Indies or the peninsula of Southeast Asia, or many peninsulas. They made the long journey into the heart of the jungle to film a native shaman at work who cast and led through his spell natives in the village into identity with their guardian animal spirit. Some of them, for example, were changed into the wild hog of the territory who fed on a poisonous root. And in the film, as they took the consciousness and the being of the hog, you saw the native suddenly go down on his hands and knees and root in the ground to find this poisonous root and eat it, which for any other villager or normal person to eat would poison him. And when the shaman brought him out of the experience, all on film, he had to be very careful to extricate from his mouth all of the remnants of the poisonous root, because when he brought him out of the spell, if he were to swallow the roots, not under the trance-like spell, though trance is not an adequate word because he was moving around being the wild hog. If when he came out of the spell, now it's too cold, if he came out of the spell, he swallowed any of that poisonous root, it would poison him. So the shaman had to very carefully clean his mouth out before he brought him out of the spell. I've been around this world in so many countries, spending weeks and months in the back country dealing with these kinds of people. But I've never seen as well a done graphic portrayal on film. I wish somebody in my audience could locate that for me. Because I'd like to see if I could negotiate a copy to play that film on our network off Westar 5. Shamanism is an ancient, ancient art. We have dismissed it as voodoo, witch doctors, medicine men. Shaman comes from the Russian-Siberian territory and has little less perceptual set of voodoo and funny man in it, and has come to have a respectability among certain schools of thought and anthropologists. Again, I'm trying to gestalt the frame of reference. The Bible speaks of a supernatural sphere of unseen beings. And I contend you don't have to cut your head off to be a Christian, and too many people have left the church for two reasons. Because it was presented in such a way that you felt you had to suck your brains out of your head and become stupid to be a Christian, or the traditions were beat into you instead of teaching you the way of faith and God taking you as you are and letting you and God work it out. The subject matter now is in that frame of restoring some dignity of respect for the truth of God's Word. The Bible's full of these unseen beings. One servant of Elisha is afraid, and Elisha says, "Drop the scales from his eyes, Lord, and let him see." And he saw the hills covered with the host of the Lord. I can go on. But the Bible is being verified to those who look that there is a supernatural or preternatural invisible world out there. Now, shamanism, in essence, postulates two states of consciousness. The ordinary state of consciousness, the realm of the five senses, except for the rare phenomenon of dreaming, where you don't have much control because you can't wake yourself up normally. Then the shaman recognizes another state of consciousness, called the shaman's state of consciousness. I'm searching for the word, accredited hardly would say it. Mature and accomplished shamans have the ability to pass from one state to the other. In the shaman state of consciousness, what the ordinary state of consciousness would call fantasy becomes reality. And in the shaman state of consciousness, what the ordinary state of consciousness dubs reality, the world in which we move and live and have our being, is dubbed unreal. The states of consciousness are analogous to going through a black hole and coming out on the other side. To you that know your space concepts of a black hole. And the accomplished shaman, without the aid of hallucinatory additives, can just pass from one state to the other. In the movie I've referred to, the shamanized, to make up a word, subject in that native village became a wild boar. He could eat the poison roots that was the food of the wild boar with no consequence. When he came back into the ordinary state of consciousness to swallow a piece of it that was lodged in his teeth, would have its usual poisonous effects on him. And the Eskimos have shamans, the Laps have shamans. Shamans were the power among many Indian tribes. There were fakers. I will probably get on the ancient oracles before I get off of this subject. There were fakers. Archaeologists have dug up one of the oracles where refined systems of trickery were installed. But that was by successors trying to imitate what they didn't have, which the original oracle had. You follow Geoffrey of Monmouth's story of the founding of Britain and Brutus from Troy, stopping at the oracle. probably happened. The prophecy probably was very real. And more people who teach on prophecy and on Antichrist and on the beast that comes out of the pit need to concentrate on the trips of Alexander the Great to the oracles from whence he derived his almost superhuman power. Yeah, almost, strike that word, his superhuman power. Now, we're on subjects far out. Well, this is a PhD in Berkeley. First introduction talks of this two states of consciousness. The ordinary state of consciousness and the shaman state of consciousness. Now, to the ordinary person, we say, well, because we live and move and have our being in the ordinary state of consciousness, that's the real state. The other one isn't. Well, most of the Oriental religions, and the real purpose of the yogi exercise was to bring a man out of the wheel of life, which is the ordinary state of consciousness, into nirvana. Undefined, undifferentiated, that which is behind all that, nothingness, which was ultimate reality and freed you from the karma and the wheel of life. And they view the ordinary state of consciousness as appearance and not reality, and ultimate reality as the that which is behind all that. Now, here is a PhD from Berkeley, an anthropologist of renown, who begins to dabble in shamanism and becomes a white shaman. To him, the reality of shamanism is now no longer a question. It's a matter of true experience to him. And his view of it would be as with the witches. The issue is to let the good shamans work and overpower the bad shamans. The Gestalt point of view I'm dealing with is there's too much evidence to ignore. There is a state of being and a reality that's out there. As the Bible says. Now, the Bible postulates reality as a war between God and the good angels and Satan who rebelled and his subordinates, a third of heaven that went out with him, and we're caught between. By analogy, I suppose, the good shamans would use good angels to overpower bad angels, but they don't view reality like that. It's a bad analogy. And the very strict fundamentalist would say the shaman is being tricked and he's working in the devil's territory and only in the devil's territory, and the devil's acting good in some ways and bad in others. What do you think? You'll see. I'll be right back. The Way of the Shaman by Michael Harner, PhD from University of California, Berkeley, teaches anthropology in the graduate faculty of the New School for Social Research in New York. Currently co-chairman of the anthropological section of the New York Academy of Sciences. He has become a practicing shaman, but it wasn't always that way. Chapter 1. My first prolonged field work as an anthropologist took place more than two decades ago on the forested eastern slopes of the Ecuadorian Andes among the Jivaro Indians, or the Utsuri Shuar. The Jivaro were famous at that time for their now essentially vanished practice of head shrinking and for their intensive practice of shamanism, which still continues. I successfully collected a great deal of information on their culture during 1956 and 57, but remained an outside observer of the world of the shaman. Now, shamanism postulates, I'll try to say this in a sentence because I've already said it, and I'd like to get into this before we leave Dallas-Fort Worth and Channel 30 in Memphis. Shamanism postulates different states of consciousness, to simplify it. The ordinary state of consciousness sees the world as it is. The shaman enters into a state of consciousness called the shaman state of consciousness, where he is in another state of reality and being. And what we call fantasy becomes reality to him, what we call reality becomes unreality to him. And the accomplished shaman can move from one to the other without the help of hallucinatory aids drugs, or chemistry. Now, the Jivaro Indians use these hallucination drugs. That's where he started. But Kampa shamans and many other cultures don't need them. I'm not for or against at this point. I'm exploring to make the point with Gestalt, hey, there's a vast evidentiary field of preternatural, unnatural, extranatural, supernatural activity totally ignored by this Western materialistic, science-dominated culture that have become as constricted in their viewpoint and frame of reference in some ways as the traditional Christians that bind you under a black tent of tradition. I want to open us up and then confirm the authority of the Bible, who's always postulated these extra realms of being. The Jivaro were famous for head shrinking. Essentially vanished now, but not totally. And shamanism, which still continues. I successfully collected a great deal of information on their culture during 1956 and 1957, but remained an outside observer. A couple of years later, oh, I know you want me to finish that exorcism, but you'll like this when I get into it. And I want the broad frame of reference before I tie all the knots. And I'm the teacher. A couple of years later, the American Museum of Natural History invited me to make a year-long expedition to the Peruvian Amazon. Now, some awful smart people lived in this area sometime who did those markings on the high desert, the plateau, the Andes Plateau of Peru. Now, American Museum of Natural History, do you understand that this is not some gook again? The American Museum of Natural History invited me to make a year-long expedition to the Peruvian Amazon to study the culture of the Conibo Indians of the Ucayali River region. You say, what's a gook? Well, bureaucrat. I accepted, delighted to have an opportunity to do more research on the fascinating upper Amazon forest cultures. That field work took place in 1960 and 1961. Two particular experiences I had among the Kurubo, or the Conibo, and the Jivaro were basic to my discovering the way of the shaman in both these cultures. And I would like to share them with you. Perhaps they will convey something of the incredible hidden world open to the shamanic explorer. I'd been living for the better part of a year in a Conibo Indian village beside a remote lake off a tributary of the Rio Ucayali. My anthropological research on the culture of the Conibo had been going well, but my attempts to elicit information on their religion met with little success. The people were friendly, but reluctant to talk about the supernatural. Finally, they told me that if I really wished to learn, I must take the shaman's sacred drink made from ayahuasca, the soul vine. I agreed with both curiosity and trepidation, for they warned me that the experience would be very frightening. The next morning, now, immediately the skeptic's going to say, aha, acid, hallucinatory drugs. You don't have to go to Amazon. Just live in Berkeley a few years ago. Haight-Ashbury. I always used to laugh at that up in San Francisco. Some poor guy came out of the area. It was a standard joke up there when I lived there. Some guy came from somewhere in the country, and all the hippies were congregated at Haight-Ashbury. And it's spelled H-A-I-G-H-T or something like that. But this guy came and said, well, all these hippies talk about love. If love's important to them, why do they live in Haight-Ashbury? I didn't think it was that funny either. I mean, I try to keep you from getting too scared, but you won't cooperate. I agreed with both curiosity and trepidation. You're going to say acid head. There are lots of PhDs from Berkeley, acid head. No, I'm just introducing shamanism. Accomplished shamans need none of this in many cultures. This was the way he was introduced. The next morning, my friend Thomas, the kind elder of the village, went into the forest to cut the vines. You want me to tell you who I believe continued shamanism? Nimrod. It was his ability to deliver people from their fear of animals that set up the first rebel kingdom. But that's another subject. Next morning, my friend Thomas, the kind elder of the village, went into the forest to cut the vines. Before leaving, he told me to fast, a light breakfast and no lunch. He returned midday with enough ayahuasca vines and leaves of the kawa plant to fill a 15-gallon pot. He boiled them all afternoon until only about a quart of dark liquid remained. This he poured into an old bottle and left it to cool until sunset, when he said we would drink it. I want some of you moonshiners down there in the South, or wherever you may be, to know you ain't got all the secrets. The Indians muzzled the dogs in the village so that they could not bark. The noise of barking dogs could drive a man who had taken ayahuasca mad. The children were cautioned to be quiet, and silence came over the small community with the setting of the sun. I want to see if this guy's going to drink this. This would make Johnny Walker red. Look like pomegranate juice. The children were cautioned to be quiet, and silence came over the small community with the setting of the sun. As the brief equatorial twilight was replaced by darkness, Tomas poured about a third of the bottle. That had been 15 gallon. That means 5 gallon distilled. About a third of the bottle into a gourd bowl and gave it to me. All the Indians were watching. I felt like Socrates amidst his Athenian compatriots accepting the hemlock. It occurred to me that one of the alternate names people in the Peruvian Amazon gave ayahuasca was, quote, the little death. I drank the potion quickly. It had a strange, slightly bitter taste. I then waited for Thomas to take his turn, but he said that he had decided not to participate after all. Stupid fool, I'd have said, no, you first. And no Texan had been tricked into this, or Kentuckian, I'll tell you that. They had me lie down on the bamboo platform under the great thatched roof of the communal house. I wonder if the American Museum of Natural History, to study the culture of the Coniba Indians in the Ucayali River region, anticipated this. They had me lie down on the bamboo platform under the great thatched roof of the communal house. The village was silent, except for the chirping of crickets and the distant calls of a howler monkey deep in the jungle. As I stared upward into the darkness, faint lines of light appeared. I want to tell you something. Remember that boy David, who could see through walls and see through things? Shaman, when they pass from ordinary state of consciousness to the shaman state of consciousness can see through opaque things. Well, they can't. It's solid. Don't you understand that what we call solid is not solid? There's more space in that camera and in this wall and in me than there is what we call solid matter. And when you extend your sensory apparatus to the electrons, the atoms, the neutrons, and protons doing their little thing, if you could extend it further, you'd find those little solid, quote, entities are more space and things, whatever things are, if they are. It's relative. In the state of shaman consciousness, accomplished shamans can see through opaque things. Now, is that a changed state of the same person, or a change of the person to a state of being of a supernatural entity? And if so, did David under possession, through the possession of the supernatural or preternatural entity, move into that state of consciousness where he could see that way? So I want to raise a question at this point. Overhead, the faint lines became brighter and gradually interlaced to form... Oh, wait a minute. As I stared upward into the darkness, faint lines of light appeared. They grew sharper, more intricate, and burst into brilliant colors. Sound came from far away, a sound like a waterfall, which grew stronger and stronger until it filled my ears. Just a few minutes earlier, I'd been disappointed, sure that the ayahuasca was not having and was not going to have any effect on me. Now the sound of rushing water flooded my brain. My jaw began to feel numb. The numbness was moving up to my temples. Overhead, the faint lines became brighter and gradually interlaced to form a canopy resembling a geometric mosaic of stained glass. The bright violet hues formed an ever-expanding roof above me. You say, yeah, acid trip. Well, we'll see. Let's keep going. Within this celestial cavern, I heard the sound of water grow louder, and I could see dim figures engaged in shadowy movements. Now, I want to make the record clear. I think anybody takes dope's dope. You have your dope to take dope. I want to make it clear in case somebody tunes in and thinks they got a Timothy Leary here. I don't even like Novocaine. I want to see the dentist coming at me. So don't say that. Within this celestial cavern, I heard the sound of water grow louder, and I could see dim figures engaged in shadowy movements. Is this fantasy? As you get into shamanism, you'll find that what we call fantasy is reality to the shaman. And he doesn't need these hallucinatory drinks to do it. As that servant of Elisha didn't need to see unseen figures that were there all along. In that case, they were good figures, but they were there to counteract bad ones. As my eyes seemed to adjust to the gloom, the moving scene resolved itself into something resembling a huge funhouse, a supernatural carnival of demons. In the center, presiding over the activities and looking directly at me, was a gigantic, grinning, crocodilian head from whose cavernous jaws gushed a torrential flood of water. And when the dragon saw, Revelation 12, a habit pattern maybe. This guy's an atheist. He admits it later. He didn't know anything about this verse of Scripture. When the dragon saw that he was cast unto the earth, he persecuted the woman which brought forth the man-child, Revelation 12:13. To the woman were given two wings of a great eagle, that she might fly into the wilderness, into her place where she is nourished for a time and times and half a time from the face of the serpent. And the serpent cast out of his mouth water as a flood after the woman, that he might cause her to be carried away of the flood. Now you'd think that this guy was having image, fantasy, impressions from past knowledge, except he will later admit, when a missionary that he goes to and talks about this points out that verse of Scripture, he'd never heard of it, never knew it. That's a future thing yet to come. But he sees this grinning crocodilian head from whose cavernous jaws gushed a torrential flood of water. Slowly the waters rose, and so did the canopy above them until the scene metamorphosed into a simple duality of blue sky above and sea below. All creatures had vanished. Then from my position near the surface of the water, I began to see two strange boats wafting back and forth, floating through the air towards me, coming closer and closer. They slowly combined to form a single vessel with a huge dragon-headed prow, not unlike that of a Viking ship. Set amidship was a square sail. Gradually, as the boat gently floated back and forth above me, I heard a rhythmic swishing sound and saw that it was a giant galley with several hundred oars moving back and forth in cadence with the sound. I became conscious, too, of the most beautiful singing I'd ever heard in my life, high-pitched and ethereal, emanating from myriad voices on board the galley. As I looked more closely at the deck, I could make out large numbers of people with heads of blue jays and the bodies of humans, not unlike the bird-headed gods of ancient Egyptian tomb paintings. At the same time, some energy essence began to float from my chest up into the boat. Although I believed myself to be an atheist, I was completely certain that I was dying and that the bird-headed people had come to take my soul away on the boat. While the soul flow continued from my chest, I was aware that the extremities of my body were going numb. Starting with my arms and legs, my body slowly began to feel like it was turning to solid concrete. I couldn't move or speak. Gradually, as the numbness closed in on my chest toward my heart, I tried to get my mouth to ask for help, to ask the Indians for an antidote. Now, did this drink transport him to some deep recess of his mind? Or did this chemical make connection with a preternatural world, like going through a black hole, giving these impressions to him? And did the possession of David in the other book give him consciousness of this other world? It had the capacity to break through, but most of the other people in the ordinary world could not be tuned to it because they weren't possessed as David was. Do you want me to continue? Huh? This is a PhD from Berkeley. Now, you know, there are people who've been on acid trips to tell you strange things. This is going to go beyond that. You interested? Oh, I'm not sure. Starting with my arms and legs, my body slowly began to feel like it was turning to solid concrete. I couldn't move or speak. Gradually, as the numbness closed in on my chest toward my heart, I tried to get my mouth to ask for help, to ask the Indians for an antidote. I'd have been Cousin Thomas at that point. Try as I might, however, I could not marshal my abilities sufficiently to make a word. Simultaneously, my abdomen seemed to be turning to stone. I had to make a tremendous effort to keep my heart beating. I began to call my heart my friend, my dearest friend of all, to talk to it, to encourage it to beat with all the power remaining at my command. How could he talk to his heart and not talk to his... Let's go on. I became aware of my brain. I felt physically that it had become compartmentalized into four separate and distinct levels. Now, when Edgar Cayce went to sleep and began to talk with those readings, did he become one with some preternatural being that had been around through all of those eons of time that could tell him all of those things that were so accurate? There's a whole big world out there that's totally ignored in a materialistic scientific community. I'm not wanting to scare people. I teach you faith. If you are faithing, even faithing little ways like we do here on the phones, battling this budget we've committed ourselves to, and you faith in your personal life, taking the promises of God, God's Spirit in you is there as God's gift to the faither who keeps the faithing connection. Greater is he that's in us than he that's in the world. But it's time we recognize these realities. I became aware of my brain. I felt physically. Give me just a hair more, but don't whistle my mic. And you talk to a mic if it gets a ring. I became aware of my brain. I felt physically that it had become compartmentalized into four separate and distinct levels. Was it his brain he became aware of? Or did he become a part of a larger brain, as some views of life would have it? You say, Gene, you're predictable. You're a biblicist. What are you coming up with all these wild questions for? We'll see, won't we? At the uppermost surface of the brain was the observer and commander, which was conscious of the condition of my body and was responsible for the attempt to keep my heart going. It perceived, but purely as a spectator, the visions emanating from what seemed to be the nether portions of my brain. Immediately below the topmost level, I felt a numbered layer. Do you have any idea how many pots would have been boiling in Berkeley in the 60s if they'd have had this soul vine? Immediately below the topmost level, I felt a numbered layer, which seemed to have been put out of commission by the drug. It just wasn't there. The next level down was the source of my visions, including the soul boat that was sucking my soul out with those birds or those beings with blue jay heads and human bodies. Now I was virtually certain I was about to die. As I tried to accept my fate, answer at King's House 1 over there, don't listen to me and not answer the phone. As I tried to accept my fate, an even lower portion of my brain began to transmit more visions and information. Now, was this his brain? Was he looking inward? Or had he been pulled out and connected to another realm of being? An even lower portion of my brain began to transmit more visions and information. Only thing I can say, thank God that that's the order. That the commander was on top and this was on the bottom. Been off been the other way around. an even lower portion of my brain began to transmit more visions and information. I was told that this new material was being presented to me because I was dying and therefore safe to receive these revelations. These were the secrets reserved for the dying and the dead, I was informed. I could only very dimly perceive the givers of these thoughts. I say that slow. I could only very dimly perceive the givers of these thoughts. Giant reptilian creatures reposing sluggishly at the lowermost depths of the back of my brain, where it met the top of the spinal column. I could only vaguely see them in what seemed to be gloomy, dark depths. Then they projected a visual scene in front of me. First, they showed me the planet Earth as it was eons ago, before there was any life on it. I saw an ocean, barren land, bright blue sky. Then black specks dropped from the sky by the hundreds and landed in front of me on the barren landscape. I wouldn't be reading this with any more attention than the written down record or tape recorded record of somebody describing an acid trip they'd just been on, except that this is the prelude to his introduction into shamanism that led him to become a white shaman who practiced healing through shamanism. This is just the beginning. I could see that the specks were actually large. Well, I saw the ocean, barren land, bright blue sky, then black specks dropped from the sky by the hundreds and landed in front of me on the barren landscape. I could see that the specks were actually large, shiny, black creatures with stubby, pterodactyl-like wings and huge, whale-like bodies. Their heads were not visible to me. They flopped down, utterly exhausted from their trip, resting for eons. They explained to me in a kind of thought language that they were fleeing from something out in space. They had come to the planet Earth to escape their enemy. Am I boring you? You ever read Edgar Cayce's readings? I guess I haven't taken you to what the Dogon people ultimately say. Nomo came and told them. The fish-like creature from the land of the fishes who told them the origin of the earth. That's another subject. I could see that the specks were actually large, shiny, black creatures with stubby, pterodactyl-like wings and huge whale-like bodies. Their heads were not visible to me. Turn it down a little. They flopped down, utterly exhausted from their trip, resting for eons. They explained to me in a kind of thought language that they were fleeing from something out in space. They had come to the planet Earth to escape their enemy. The creatures then showed me how they had... We got that extra microphone. I think the battery's going on this one. Either get me some new batteries or let me change. Let's start with new batteries. You want me to continue or just, is your battery gone too? Your ear battery's all right? The creatures then showed me how they had created life on the planet in order to hide within the multitudinous forms and thus disguise their presence. Now, this would be right along with what the Cathars and the Gnostics believe, that the Demiurge created this earth. Did they go into the shaman state of consciousness? Well, let's see. Before me, the magnificence of plant and animal creation and speciation, hundreds of millions of years of activity took place on a scale and with a vividness impossible to describe. I learned that the dragon-like creatures were thus inside all forms of life, including man. They were the true masters of humanity and the entire planet, they told me. We humans were but the receptacles and servants of these creatures. For this reason, they could speak to me from within myself. And doesn't that sound like, you know, let's assume the veracity of the shaman experience, that he's not a full shaman yet, this is the beginning. But let's also look at it from another frame. Doesn't that sound like the lie that Satan would like to have us believe, if he could get us into a state where he could put these impressions on us? These revelations welling up from the depths of my mind alternated with visions of the floating galley, which had almost finished taking my soul on board. Now, I'd like to finish this shaman stuff tonight so I can get back. Well, I'm not going to finish shamanism, but I'd like to finish this particular story tonight. So hang tight with me. The boat with its blue jay-headed deck crew was gradually drawing away, pulling my life force along with it, headed toward a large fjord flanked by barren, worn hills. I knew I had only a moment more to live. Strangely, I had no fear of the bird-headed people. They were welcome to have my soul if they could keep it. But I was afraid that somehow my soul might not remain on the horizontal plane of the fjord, but might, through processes unknown but felt and dreaded, be acquired and reacquired by the dragon-like denizens of the depths. I suddenly felt my distinctive humanness. The contrast between my species... Hey, this is a PhD from Berkeley, not experimenting as a student, on assignment by the American Museum of Natural History in Peru. An anthropologist of renown. I suddenly felt my distinctive humanness, the contrast between my species and the ancient reptilian ancestors. I began to struggle against returning to the ancient ones, who were beginning to feel increasingly alien and possibly evil. Every heartbeat was a major undertaking. I turned to human help. With an unimaginable last effort, I barely managed to utter one word to the Indians. Medicine! I saw them rushing around to make an antidote, and I knew they could not prepare it in time. I needed a guardian who could defeat dragons, and I frantically tried to conjure up a powerful being to protect me against the alien reptilian creatures. One appeared before me, and at that moment the Indians forced my mouth open and poured the antidote upon me, or into me. Gradually the dragons disappeared back into the lower depths. The soul boat and the fjord were no more. I relaxed with relief. The antidote, gradually. How does your phone always... Oh, there it is. Okay. How do these phones keep going? I thought poor old Gloria, she's not old, I thought poor dear Gloria was being harassed again. I'm glad that you're not, Gloria. It costs $1,000 a second to talk any longer in here now. Gradually, the dragons disappeared back into the lower depths. The soul boat and the fjord were no more. I relaxed with relief. The antidote radically eased my condition, but it did not prevent me from having many additional visions of a more superficial nature. These were manageable and enjoyable. I made fabulous journeys at will through distant regions, even out into the galaxy, created incredible architecture and employed sardonically grinning demons to realize my fantasies, Often I found myself laughing aloud at the incongruities of my adventures. Finally, I slept. He will go to an old blind shaman later. Let's keep going. Rays of sunlight were piercing the holes in the palm-thatched roof when I awoke. I was still lying on the bamboo platform, and I heard the normal morning sounds all around me. The Indians conversing, babies crying, rooster crowing. I was surprised to discover that I felt refreshed, even peaceful. As I lay there looking up at the beautiful woven pattern of the roof, the memories of the previous night drifted across my mind. It'd be awful to go through that and wake up with a hangover. I momentarily stopped myself from remembering more in order to get my tape recorder from a duffel bag. As I dug into the bag, several of the Indians greeted me smiling. An old woman, Thomas' wife, gave me a bowl of fish and plantain soup for breakfast. It tasted extraordinarily good. Then I went back to the platform, eager to put my night's experience on tape before I forgot anything. The work of recall went easily except for one portion of the trance that I could not remember. It remained blank, as though a tape had been erased. I struggled for hours to remember what had happened in that part of the experience, and I virtually wrestled it back into my consciousness. The recalcitrant material turned out to be the communication from the dragon-like creatures, including the revelation of their role in the evolution of life on this planet and their innate domination of living matter, including man. I was highly excited at rediscovering this material and could not help but feel that I was not supposed to be able to bring it back from the nether regions of the mind. I even had a peculiar sense of fear for my safety, because I now possessed a secret that the creatures had indicated was only intended for the dying. I immediately decided to share this knowledge with others so that the secret would not reside in me alone and my life would not be in jeopardy. I don't know where he concluded that. I guess misery loves company. I put my outboard motor on a dugout canoe and left for an American evangelist mission station nearby. I arrived about noon. Atheist now, heading for a preacher. The couple at the mission, Bob and Millie, were a cut above the average evangelist sent from the United States, hospitable, humorous, and compassionate. Well, I'd say all three of those. I told them my story. When I described the reptile with water gushing out of his mouth, they went to the book of Revelation, read the 12th chapter as I did earlier. I listened with surprise and wonder. The missionaries, in turn, seemed to be awed by the fact that an atheistic anthropologist, by taking the drink of the witch doctors, could apparently have revealed to him a view of an evil creature like that described in Revelation 12. Chance? Probably. Maybe not. When I had finished my account, I was relieved to have shared my new knowledge, but I was also exhausted. I fell asleep on the missionary's bed, leaving them to continue their discussion of the experience. That evening, as I returned to the village in my canoe, my head began to throb in rhythm with the noise of the outboard motor. I thought I was going mad. I had to stick my fingers in my ears to avoid the sensation. I slept well, but the next day I noticed a numbness or pressure in my head. I was now eager to solicit a professional opinion from the most supernaturally knowledgeable of the Indians, a blind shaman who had made many excursions into the spirit world with the aid of the Ayahuasca drink. It seemed only proper that a blind man might be able to be my guide in the world or to the world of darkness. I went to his hut, taking my notebook with me, and described my visions to him, segment by segment. At first, I told him only the highlights. Thus, when it came to the dragon-like creatures, I skipped their arrival from space and only said, there were these giant black animals, something like great bats, longer than the length of this house, who said that they were the true masters of the world. There's no word for dragon in Conibo, so giant bat was the closest I could come to describe what I'd seen. He stared up toward me with his sightless eyes and said with a grin, "Oh, they're always saying that." Are you making any connections? Oh. The reason I'm trying to push your brain, you that listen through all of these sessions, and make you hang on to it, the gestalt's going to begin to come when you encounter. What we're doing is reading the reports of the four blind men who ran into the legs and the trunk of an elephant, each giving their own versions. I don't want to talk down to you. I'm just telling you, keep letting me dump all the mass. You're going to see some interconnections. Oh, they're always saying that. But they are only the masters of outer darkness. I'm telling you. Most Christians would not even read a book like this. But everywhere you turn, limited views of this preternatural reality are only going to be synthesized when you get the Hebraic Christian biblical view of it. Now, the old master shaman had made enough trips, he couldn't be fooled by the lying voices that claimed more than what they were. Like the demon continued to roar out in David, he was bigger than God. But this old shaman, he's not fooled. Oh, he stared up toward me with his sightless eyes and said with a grin, oh, they're always saying that. But they're only the masters of outer darkness. That's consistent with the prince of the power of the air, wickedness in high places. He waved his hand casually toward the sky. I felt a chill along the lower part of my spine, for I had not yet told him that I had seen them in my trance coming from outer space. I was stunned. What I had experienced was already familiar to this barefoot blind shaman, known to him from his own explorations of the same hidden world into which I had ventured. From that moment on, I decided to learn everything I could about shamanism. And there was something more that encouraged me in my new quest. After I recounted my entire experience, he told me that he didn't know of anyone who had encountered and learned so much on his first ayahuasca journey. You can surely be a master shaman, he said. Thus my serious study of shamanism began. From the Conibo, I especially learned about the journey into the lower world and the retrieval of spirits, the specialty of Semiramis, the wife of Nimrod, who journeyed into the netherworld to restore Tammuz, and the bases of Satan's counterfeit religion. Let's go. I returned to the United States in 1961, but 3 years later I came back to South America to be with the Jivaro, with whom I had lived in 56 and 1957. My mission this time was not just to be an anthropologist, but to learn firsthand how to practice shamanism the Jivaro way. For that reason, I wanted to go to the northwestern part of the Jivaro country where the most powerful shamans were reputed to reside. Now, I'm sure we can get a copy of that film from the National Geographic. If the National Geographic Society owns it, I'm sure we can get it on shamanism. It's going to blow you away. I first flew to Quito, Ecuador in the Andean Highlands. I took an old Junkers trimotor down to a jungle airfield at the eastern base of the Andes on the Pastaza River. There, I chartered a single-engine plane to Macas, an ancient white settlement at the foot of the Andes in the midst of the Jivaro country. Macas was a strange village. It had been founded in 1599 by a handful of Spaniards who had survived the massacre of the legendary Sevilla del Oro by the Jivaro, and for centuries had been perhaps the most isolated community of the Western world, until the airstrip was built in the 1940s. Its most direct connection to the outside world had been a slippery footpath over the Andean escarpment west of the village, involving an arduous 8-day hike to reach the highland city of Riobamba. This isolation had created a white community unlike any other in the world. Even during the early years of the 20th century, the men hunted with blowguns, wore Indian dress, and proudly declared their direct descent from the conquistadores. They also had their own marvelous legends and private mysteries. For example, there was the story of how after the massacre and the retreat from Sevilla del Oro, it took them almost a century to find a new way out over the Andes. The man who had finally succeeded was still remembered in bedtime stories to the children. And there was the spectral horse, complete with clanking chains, which was reportedly such a frequent night visitor to the streets of the village that the inhabitants often huddled inside the palm-thatched huts while the monster roamed about. Its visits ended in 1924 when Catholic missionaries permanently settled in the community. At that time, incidentally, there were still no horses in Macas or Macas. The first one, a colt, was carried in on a man's back from Riobamba in 1928, almost 3.5 centuries after the community's founding. Up behind the village, surmounting the eastern cordillera of the Andes, was Sangay, a great active volcano, snow-capped, billowing smoke by day and glowing by night. The glow, the Macabeos like to say, was produced by the treasure of the Incas, which they claim was buried on the slopes of the Sangay. My first day in Macas or Macas went well. My young Jivaro guide was awaiting me at the airstrip. The people were hospitable and generous. Food was plentiful, and our meals included generous portions of meat. Too cold now. Since there was no way for the Macabeos to get their cattle over the Andes, they had to eat the beasts themselves. Thus, cattle were slaughtered in the little village every day. In addition, they gave me guayusa, a native tea, which the Macabeos consumed throughout the day instead of coffee. The tea created a sense of euphoria, and the entire local population was gently stoned all day. Guayusa is so habituating that before it is offered to a visitor, he is warned that once he drinks it, he will ever after always return to the Ecuadorian jungle. As I drifted off to sleep in Macas that night of my arrival, images, having drunk the tea, in brilliant reddish hues appeared to me in the darkness of the Macabeo house. What I saw was most peculiar, curvilinear designs intertwining, separating, and turning in a most enjoyable fashion. Then small, grinning, demonic faces, which were also red, appeared among the changing patterns, swirling, disappearing, and reappearing. I felt I was seeing the spiritual inhabitants of Macas. Suddenly, with an explosion and a jolt, I was almost thrown off my slat bed. You don't like this shaman stuff, do you? It's too cold in here. The dogs of the village burst out barking. The visions vanished. People were shouting. Just ordinary this time. An earthquake had shaken the ground, and now a spray of natural fireworks shot into the night sky from Sangay. I felt undoubtedly, irrationally, that the sardonic demons had produced the eruption to greet my return to the jungle and to remind me of their reality. I laughed to myself at the absurdity of it all. The next day, the Catholic missionary showed me his private collection of prehistoric potsherds from the local area. On them were painted red designs of almost identical to those I'd seen the previous night. The following morning, my Jivaro guide and I walked northward from Macas, crossed the Rio Upana in a dugout canoe, and continued walking all day. At sunset, exhausted, we reached our destination, the house of a famous shaman, Akachu, deep in the forest. There was no guayusa that evening. Instead, I was preferred bowl after bowl of refreshing manioc beer, or maybe maniac, monkey meat, and raw, squirming, but delicious cheese-like grubs. King's House Banquet. There was no guayusu that evening. Instead, I was preferred bowl after bowl of refreshing manioc beer, monkey meat, and raw, squirming, but delicious cheese-like grubs. But that's when you're glad you smoke a pipe. Tired but delighted to be back among shamans, I fell into a deep sleep on the bamboo bed. I remember some things they've offered me on the mission field. In the morning, Akachu and I sat formally opposite each other on wooden stools as his wives brought us bowls of warmed manioc beer. Breakfast, supper. His long black hair bound into a ponytail with a woven red and white strap from which a feathered tassel hung showed streaks of gray. I guessed he was in his 60s. I have come, I explained, to acquire spirit helpers, to scent sock. He stared hard at me without saying a word, but the wrinkles in his brown face seemed to deepen. All of life is a matter of exchange. That is a very spiritual shaman. That's a fine gun there, he observed, jutting his chin toward the Winchester shotgun I'd brought along for hunting. His message was clear. For the standard payment among the Hivaro for shamanic initiation was at the very least a muzzle-loading shotgun. The breech-loading, cartridge-using Winchester was far more powerful than the black powder muzzle-loaders and thus much more valuable. To acquire knowledge and spirit helpers, I will give you the gun and my two boxes of cartridges, I said. The Akachu nodded. Reached his arm out in the direction of the Winchester. I picked up the gun, carried it over him. He tested its weight and balance and sighted along the barrel. Then abruptly, he laid the gun across his knee. First, you must bathe in the waterfall, he said. Then we will see. I told him I was ready to do whatever he said. You are not a Shuar, an Indian, the Akachu said, so I do not know if you will have success, but I will help you try. He pointed westward toward the Andes with his chin. Soon we will make the journey to the waterfall. 5 days later, Akachu, his son-in-law, Sangu, and I departed on the pilgrimage to the sacred waterfall. My Hivaro guide, his duties finished, had already gone home. The first day, we followed a forest trail upstream along a twisting river valley. My companions kept up a very fast pace, and I was thankful when we at last stopped in late afternoon beside a small rapid in the river. The Akachu and Sangu constructed a palm-thatched lean-to with a layer of palm fronds for our bed. I slept soundly, kept warm with a slow fire they built in the entrance of the shelter. Second day, our journey was almost continuous climb upward into the mist-shrouded forest. As the virtually non-existent trail became more difficult, we paused at a grove of Caña Brava to cut hiking staffs to help us in the ascent. Akachu briefly went off and returned with a 3-inch thick pole of balsa wood. While we rested, he quickly carved it with simple geometric designs and then handed it to me. This is your magical staff, he said. It will protect you from demons. If you encounter one, throw it at him. It is more powerful than a gun. I fingered the pole. It was extremely light and obviously would be of no use in defending oneself against anything material. For a moment I felt as though we were children playing a game of make-believe. Yet these men were warriors, warriors who engaged in repeated life-and-death feuds and wars with their enemies. Didn't their survival depend upon being in genuine contact with reality? As the day progressed, the trail became steeper and more slippery. Often it seemed that I was sliding one step back into the adobe-like mud for each two steps I made forward. We frequently rested to catch our breath and to sip water mixed with the manioc beer mash in our bottle-gourd canteens. Sometimes the others would snack on the smoked, boiled manioc or smoked meat that they carried in their monkey-skin pouches. I, however, was forbidden to eat solid food. "You must suffer," Sangu explained, "so that the grandfathers will take pity on you. Otherwise, the ancient specter will not come." That night, tired and hungry, I attempted to sleep in the palm thatch lean-to my companions had constructed for us on the top of a cold, dank ridge. Now, what did Jesus need after fasting 40 days and 40 nights in the wilderness? Something out of his mind? A fantasy? Or a reality? Satan. Oh, the Christians say, he met a real substance devil. But all these people meet are fantasy. Well, if he met a real substance devil, maybe these do. Or, if this is all fantasy, was he just a creature of his age and having fantasy? Now, Canon Brian Green, whom I love like a spiritual father, he argues with me every time he comes here. Devil's just a force. Therefore, those records of demons and talking demons and Satan in the wilderness are just fantasies of the mind, poetic figures for an evil force that opposes the good. And you know where I stand. He met a real devil. All I'm asking you to do is recognize that he's still around. Let me just leave him on this journey, heading toward this waterfall. Well, let's get to the waterfall. Just let me say this story. He gets lost, terrible experience. Finally, he gets into the waterfall. Each step, oh no, here we are. "You must now start to bathe," Pikachu said. He pointed to my staff. "Bring your balsa and come with me." While Sangu sat on the sandbar, Pikachu led me over the rocks along the edge of the great pool into which the cascade poured. Soon we were up against the wet cliff face as drenching sprays pelted our bodies. He took my hand and inched forward along the base of the cliff. The water poured with mounting strength upon us, making it difficult to avoid being swept away. I supported myself with my staff with one hand and hung on to a kachu with the other. Each step forward became more difficult. Then suddenly we were underneath the waterfall in a dark natural recess. It seemed like a magical cave. Light entered only through the immense sheet of falling water which sealed us off from the rest of the world. The incessant roar of the cascade was greater than even that of my first vision years before. It seemed to penetrate my whole being. We were sealed from the world by the basic elements of earth and water. The house of the grandfathers, Akachu shouted in my ear. He pointed to my staff. He had told me earlier what to do. I began to walk back and forth in the incredible chamber, putting my staff before me with each step. As instructed, I continuously shouted, "Tau, Tau, Tau." Interesting. The ancient name of the cross, which is the root of the name Tammuz, which traces back to the four rivers in Eden, Atlantis, I think. I continued shouting, "Tau, Tau, Tau," to attract attention of the grandfathers. I was thoroughly chilled from the spray that swept the small cave, water which not long before had been reposing in the glacial lakes of the highest Andes. I shivered, paced, and shouted. Akachu accompanied me, but without a staff. Gradually, a strange calm pervaded my consciousness. I no longer felt cold, no longer felt tired, no longer felt hungry. The sound of the cascading water grew more and more distant and seemed strangely soothing. I felt that this was where I belonged, that I'd come home. The wall of falling water became iridescent, a torrent of millions of liquid prisms, and as they went by, I had the continuous sensation of floating upward, as low as though they were stable, and I was the one in motion. Flying inside of a mountain, I laughed at the absurdity of the world. Finally, Akachu grasped my shoulder, stopped me, and took my hand. He led me out of the magic mountain. Back along the cliff to Sangu, I was sorry to leave the sacred place. He leads him back to Sangu, back to the plateau, up into the jungle, to a gallery of immense trees. After about 5 minutes, Sangu stopped, started to cut boughs for the lean-to. Akachu began splitting a stick at one end. He split the same end a second time at a right angle to the first cut, stuck the unsplit end in the ground. Into the crosswise split, he pushed two twigs, which forced the end open into a four-pronged receptacle. Then he took a fist-sized gourd cup from his monkey-skin shoulder bag and put it into the space formed with the prongs. He reached again into his pouch, brought forth a bundle of short green stems. They were the Maikua, a Brugmansia species of Datura. The Maikua plant cuttings he had collected prior to our departure from his house. One by one, he held the stems over the gourd cup and scraped off the green bark. When he had finished, the cup was almost full. He reached in, drew out the shavings, began squeezing the green juice into the cup. Within 5 minutes, there was about an eighth of a cup of the liquid. He threw away the shavings. "Now we will let the Maikua cool," he said. "When night comes, you will drink it. You alone will drink, for we must guard you. We will be with you at all times, so do not fear." Sangu had joined us. Now he added, "What is most important is that you must have no fear. If you see something frightening, you must not flee. You must run up and touch it." "Akachu grasped my shoulder. That is right. You must do that, or one day soon you will die. Hold your balsa at all times in your hand so that you can do the touching." I began to feel a strong sense of panic. Not only were their words somewhat less than comforting, but I had heard that persons sometimes died or permanently lost their minds from taking Maikua. I also remembered stories of Hivaro, who had taken Maikua and become so delirious that they had dashed wildly through the forest to fall from cliffs or to drown. You're going to say, some other nut on PCP. "For this reason, they never took Maikua with sober companions to restrain them." "Will you hold me down strongly?" I asked. "That'll be done, brother," said Akachu. It was the first time he'd addressed me by a kinship term, and that one word reassured me. Still, as I waited for the dark, rising anticipation and curiosity were mixed with fears. My companions did not make a fire. And as night came, we were all stretched out side by side on palm fronds. You notice all this happens at night. Are you beginning to make some interconnects? What did the Bible say? I prefer darkness to light because the deeds are evil. Yeah, come on, I know many of you have been here many hours, but hang tight with me. You know, help me get it out to them. My companions did not make a fire, and as night came, we were all stretched out side by side on palm fronds, listening to the stillness of the forest and the distant roar of the waterfall. At last, the time came. Akachu gave me the gourd cup. I tipped it up and swallowed the contents. The taste was somewhat disagreeable, yet slightly similar to green tomatoes. I felt a numbing sensation. I thought of that other drink 3 years before among the Kanibo, which had led me here. Was my shamanic quest worth the danger? Shortly, however, even quasi-logical thought vanished as an inexpressible terror. Now, let me stop there for a minute. He goes on and on into the shaman studies until he becomes a true shaman, white shaman. What a lot of people do not know, and they laugh at it, is the journey power. These shamans have the ability to concentrate on a hole or a tunnel. Let me see if I can find a... Well, here's one I want you to see. Shamans often work in a house plunged into total darkness. Or they may allow a small fire or lamp to burn, but sometimes even a small amount of light can interfere with the shamanic seeing. Thus, among the Chukchi of Siberia, the shamanic session is thus. Began as usual, in the dark, but when the shaman suddenly broke off beating the drum, the lamp was again lighted and the face of the shaman immediately covered with a piece of cloth. Remember David? The shamanic journey is one of the most important tasks to be undertaken. Now, 99 out of 100 people will write this off as a non-happening. The shamanic journey is one of the most important tasks to be undertaken. The basic form of this journey, and the one usually easiest to learn, is the journey to the lower world. To undertake this, now I left him with the terror approaching, okay? To undertake this, a shaman typically has a special hole or entrance into the lower world. This entrance exists in ordinary reality as well as in non-ordinary reality. Well, let me gestalt it out to a black hole. Now, a black hole captures light. Nobody can ever tell us what it's like to encounter a black hole. We know what white dwarfs are. It's a compression of the mass. Squeeze this earth of ours down to a golf ball, and you'd have a white dwarf. That's what Sirius B is, that goes around Sirius A and makes it wobble because of the gravitational power. As you compress the mass down, the gravitational power increases. Now, white dwarfs, you can see. Black holes take it further. Keep pressing it until the gravity is so strong it catches light now. Instead of light, our measurement of ultimate speed and the ultimate measuring device of intergalactic connections is gone. Now, Einstein discovered that gravity can bend light. But the discovery of black holes is the discovery of nothingness. Yet you know something's there, but you can't find it because there's no light coming from it. The terror of interplanetary travel, should such happen, is that when you go past a black hole, there is a certain point where the speed of light is stopped, and then you disappear. You encounter that black hole, you see, because light rays make you see. There's no light that comes from the black hole. Now, there have been geometric designs that try to picture what happens. It's as though you pull inward, and it's like take a balloon out here and somehow suck on it until it comes through and goes out the other side. And you may have a momentary felt gestalt of a black hole. Now, some have speculated that's the entrance to heaven. Because all we can conceive is you're brought into nothingness. The great Siberian forest explosion that flattened the trees was viewed by some as possibly a black hole hitting this earth and going through it. But nobody knows what would happen to you at a black hole. Would it suck this earth out of existence? And that wasn't, I'm sure, what happened to the Siberian explosion. Now, many have speculated, since the black hole brings everything down within itself, does it somehow invert and go into another dimension? Now, in a microscopic comparison, the shaman typically has a special hole or entrance into the lower world. This entrance exists in ordinary reality as well as non-ordinary reality. The entrance amongst California Indian shamans, for example, frequently was a spring, especially a hot spring. So ordinary consciousness would see the spring as the hole. As the white dwarf would be the spring, but one stage further, black hole, and you disappear. To try to carry an analogy as I make it up in my own mind, the spring is in ordinary consciousness the whole. The shaman identifies a particular hole that can be seen in ordinary experience. In the California Indian shamans, the springs. But their entrance into that hole takes them to a realm of consciousness into the lower world. Shamans were reputed to travel hundreds of miles underground, entering one hot spring, coming out at another. Aw.
There ain't no way!
Australian shamans of the Shipara tribe were similarly believed to dive into the ground and come out again where they liked. And those of Fraser Island were said to go into the earth and come out again at a considerable distance. Similarly, a King Bushman shaman in the Kalahari Desert of southern Africa recounted, "My friend, that's the way of this Noom power. When people sing, I dance, I enter the earth, I go into the place like a place where people drink water, a water hole. I travel in a long way, very far." Oh, this just... I'm going to lose all credibility. I didn't write this. This damn PhD from Berkeley. Not a Stanford man. Stanford man wouldn't write this. You say, do you believe any of this? None of it. Not a damn jot or tittle of it. Now, the gestalt is the universal awareness of this boundary where you go through some black hole that ends the conscious seeing and come out on the other side to a shaman state of consciousness. Now, did they really go in this hole and come out somewhere else? Or did they, like that PhD laying on that cot, make all those trips out to space and other places, but really never go? But which self was the real self anyway? How those doors in the Donovan house dematerialize and come out somewhere else? Let's keep reading this big lie. Another entrance used by California Indians was a hollow tree stump. Among the Runta or Randa of Australia, hollow tree was an entrance to the underworld. The Conibo Indians taught me to follow the roots of the giant Catahoua tree down to the ground and into the ground to reach the lower world. In the shaman state of consciousness, the roots were transformed for me and my Conibo friends into black serpents down whose backs we slid to reach lands of forests, lakes, and rivers, and strange cities bright as day, lit by a sun that had disappeared from the ordinary world above, for these journeys were taken at night. You hear what I just said? Strange cities, bright as day, lit by a sun that had disappeared from the ordinary world above, for these journeys were taken at night. Other shamans' entrances into the lower world include caves, holes of burrowing animals, and even special holes in the dirt floor of houses. Among the Tuana of the northwest coast of North America, for example, the surface of the earth floor was reported often physically broken open for the descent. Entrances into the lower world commonly led down into a tunnel or tube that conveys the shaman to an exit, which opens out upon bright and marvelous landscapes. From there, the shaman travels wherever he desires for minutes or even hours, finally returning back up through the tube, henceforth called the tunnel, to emerge at the surface where he entered. A fine description of a shaman using this classic and widespread method is given by Rasmussen from the Igloolik Eskimo of Hudson Bay. For the very greatest shamans, the way opens right from the house whence they invoke their helping spirits. A road down through the earth, if they are in a tent on shore, or down through the sea, if it is in a snow hut on the sea ice, and by this route the shaman is led down without encountering any obstacle. He almost glides as if falling through a tube, so fitted to his body that he can check his progress by pressing against the sides, and need not actually fall down with a rush. This tube is kept open for him by all the souls of his namesakes until he returns on his way back to earth. When the Eskimo shaman returns from his journey, and his body stays in the same place, yet he's gone through this hole. When the Eskimo shaman returns from his journey to the lower world, the people in the tent or igloo can hear him coming a long way off. The rush of his passage through the tube, kept open for him by his spirits, comes nearer and nearer, and with a mighty pluahihi, I'm just reading it, he shoots up into his place behind the curtain. Sometimes when the shaman enters down through the hole, he finds himself ascending or descending a stream or river, which may or may not be clearly part of the tunnel. Thus, a Tavgi Samoyed shaman, recounting his first journey through the entrance into the lower world, said, "As I looked around, I noticed a hole in the earth. The hole became larger and larger. He and his guardian spirit companion, descended through it and arrived at a river with two streams flowing in opposite directions. Well, find out about this one too," said my companion. "One stream goes from the center to the north, the other to the south, the sunny side." Outstanding shamans not only see in the shaman state of consciousness, but hear, feel, and even experience communications or sensations beyond the usual senses. Thus a Samoyed shaman heard his guardian spirit. And thus a Poma Indian woman shaman in California told me how she felt a gigantic power animal move under her as she traveled alongside or traveled inside a mountain through the tunnel. Among the Bellacoola Indians of the Northwest Coast, each house reportedly had a hole in the earth floor which was used as an entrance into the lower world. Now, all you disbelievers, go sit on that hole for a while. The world below us is called Asiwata Nim. Descriptions of the lower world are principally obtained from shamans who believe they have visited that country during a trance. According to the statement of an old woman who believed that as a little girl she had visited the lower world during a trance, the entrance is through a hole situated in each house between the doorway and the fireplace. Entrance to the Hopi Indian lower world, located in the Grand Canyon west of the Hopi villages. Source Center of Astrogeology, U.S. Geological Survey. Get a picture of this. This mound with a hole used by the Hopi Indian shaman. And don't ask me whether there's any body transported in and out. Most of the shaman experiences of the journey into the lower world, the body's in a trance-like state, but their real self takes off through this tunnel and goes. There are myriad numbers of drawings in here by shamans of their experience as they've gone through these holes. The shaman's mask is designed to emphasize the hole that they go through. And find some more drawings of some of their shaman tunnels. Looks like drawings of people on acid. Here's in the hole, through the tunnel. Another looking down tunnel experience as they see it in their mind. They're pulled out of the body most of the time into this experience. Make the trips and see. Now, that's only introduction. I hope I can get this National Geographic magazine. And the way that the good shamans combat the bad shamans, the eating of insects and grubs and bugs that personify the forces that they will release. They suck the evil ones out of people and vomit it on the ground. The point I'm making, this is as old as man himself. I think reintroduced in the post-flood world by Nimrod. That's another subject as I get further into it. The gestalt I want you to feel. This is a PhD anthropologist of renown, totally committed to the way of the shaman. I studied under Spiegelberg, the Vedanta faith in India. The yogi thinks it's exercise and a way to lose weight. What those graduated, advanced yogis could do is they could induce within themselves the trance-like state of nirvana and lose consciousness of the world around them and become one with the real reality as they saw it. I studied under Kishimoto. Probably after Anasaki, and he was Anasaki's student, the leading Zen Buddhist scholar in the world today. I'm simply saying the Western world is as limited in their view of things as that little Chinese baby in Taiwan. I'd fallen sick in Hong Kong, flew to Formosa, as it was then called, into the city of Taipei, had to stay over because I was sick. There was no regular tourist hotel available. I stayed at a hotel in the native section alone for 2 or 3 days as I was recovering from the sickness, finally able to get out and go down into the street and the people. I went into a barbershop below the hotel, full of the barbers were women. I went in hoping I could be understood, pointing, trying to get across at one to shave. Heard a commotion at the door, and I've told my people this before, but it's relevant now. Big commotion at the door, and they brought a little Chinese baby over. Very young. One look's all it took. That baby started to scream and squall and caterwaul. And they'd laugh and giggle and take it back to the door and calm it down. As soon as it calmed down, they'd bring it for another look. Ah! They'd take off. All it took for that poor baby that had never seen anyone but Chinese to see this white man. I was the specter, monster, drove that kid bananas. It really taught me how a limited frame of reference views everybody from inside yourself. We're normal and everybody else is different. I was a freak to that baby. A real freak. They enjoyed. When I figured out what was going on, first I thought it was funny, then I began to think about it. From our Western world, we are so closed in with materialism that the Bible's discussions of another world out there, of a servant of Elisha that gets his eyes open and sees the hills covered with the Lord's hosts, an angel that comes, kills 180,000 snack ribs troops in one night. I've read Bible scholars that try to explain that as a plague that hit the camp that night. Massive diarrhea that killed them all. That in their limited intelligence, they credited to angels. The angel comes, talks to Daniel, says, I'm bringing the answer to your prayer. I heard it 3 weeks ago, but the prince of Persia restrained me. Michael, I had to call him in to help me. I once stood with Michael at war against him. Now, Michael's standing with me. We fought for 3 weeks before I could get here. Now, I'm going to go back. And when I go back, we're going to do him in, and then the prince of Grecia will come. Locust demons coming out of the bottomless pit, led by an evil demon called Abaddon. We've even got fundamentalist evangelists trying to figure out ways to make that turn into helicopters, because they're not willing, not as good as the Catholics, to accept the reality of these unseen demon forces. Those aren't helicopters, those are demons. You wonder why there's so much evil emanating out of Iran, and the news tonight is full of new threats to American citizens, including newsmen. 200 million evil demon forces are chained in the river Euphrates area to be released during the tribulation. I'm in the business of proving the intelligence of God's Word. And modern minds have scoffed at it, but a broad gestalt that gets out of a limited little pea-brain box understands the world bigger than some little fellow who's teaching what his professor taught him, who never got out of the same classroom. And I've covered enough to now sort of start coming down with the reason I'm doing it. I don't care whether this is all these stories are true or not. There's too much happening to write off the preternatural, supernatural, extranatural, invisible world that the Bible talks about. I haven't got to Edgar Cayce yet. What's the basis for the empirical evidence of reincarnation? Do we reincarnate? If we do, then we got some problems, because that's not what the United Hebraic Christian Individual Immortality view of things teaches. But do you make contact on occasions with preternatural other dimensions of consciousness, to where beings that you're in contact with in that world who have the memory because they've been here, possessing bodies after bodies through generation after generation, who have the memory, when they begin to think through you, you'll think you were there. I was that girl. Hey, at this point, I'm not yet ready to take sides on the issue, except to say, a man knows very little about the evidence that says the pragmatic evidence is not there for the reincarnation experience. But I'm saying, as a biblical scholar, you can have the experience and it still doesn't prove that that was you back there in that other body that you're now remembering. There is a borderline, like the difference between the universe as we know it and the black hole, where we touch invisible forces. And we are caught between this interplay of divine and evil forces at war. Both the Jewish and Christian heritage teach that, radiating out of every book of their holy scriptures. And the heathen know more than the modern man about it. And we have no chance against the evil forces without the supernatural power of God. And you need the implant of his life. And you're only going to get it if you practice faith.